I'm Rachel Greenberg, and this is Volta Insider. I'm here with Graham Moore, Oscar-winning writer of The Imitation Game and New York Times bestselling author. We're here to talk about his new book, The Last Days of Night. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks for chatting with me. Thanks for having me.
So, why did you choose to write about the rivalry between Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse?
You know, I think the thing that I first got excited about with this book was writing about the invention of indoor electrical light, which felt to me like this wonderful hinge moment in history. This time when the night sky was lit up for the very first time. And when I started researching the period, reading about it, you know, I was so shocked to read the diaries and the journals of people living at the time. And the way they describe seeing light bulbs for the first time, they talked about it as if they were seeing a new color. They had kind of never seen anything like that, like it. The effect was shocking, kind of literally and figuratively for them. And it just felt like this amazing hinge moment when culture and American society would never be the same again. I mean, the electrical light had all these dramatic changes. You know, crime rates went down because it was really hard to rob people in public spaces if they were much brighter. Factories began running 24 hours a day because you could light them up at night. And that meant that a lot of the what became the modern labor movement was birthed from a reaction to factories being open 24 hours a day. So you got all these great kind of social and cultural changes happening, all as a result of this one invention, the light bulb. And what seemed so interesting to me was that there were these three different people, Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla, who kind of each thought they were the one who invented the light bulb. And that was the question that I first started asking myself when I started researching this, was how was it that three different people each thought that he was the one to invent the light bulb?
Wow, that's very cool. I remember learning about this in school, and I just thought it was so interesting. So it's nice to hear it in a literary sense as well.
Thank you.
As a writer, what attracted you to these mathematicians and these scientists?
It's funny, I do seem to have a habit of writing about mathematicians and scientists and other people who are much smarter than I am. It's a strange obsession I seem to develop. But I think I'm really attracted to really smart characters. I'm attracted to geniuses, I think, because I'm not one, because I'm really fascinated by what it must feel like to think so differently, to have a mind that functions so differently from most of ours. It's something I noticed kind of connecting the different pieces I've worked on. You know, The Imitation Game was... we always talked about it as being this movie about a mathematician from the perspective of the mathematician. It was all told from Alan Turing's perspective. There is all this voiceover and structural work to make very clear that what you're watching as a film is a subjective bit of storytelling. You're hearing Alan Turing's version of the Alan Turing story. You're hearing his life story as he would explain it to you. And then with Last Days of Night, maybe in some sense as a reaction to it, I did kind of the opposite thing, which was telling the story of these three great scientists, Edison, Westinghouse, and Tesla, maybe the three great scientists of the late 19th century, but telling it not from any of their perspectives, telling it from the perspective of Paul Cravath, this 26-year-old lawyer, new to New York, new to being a lawyer, kind of in way over his head as he tries his first case and has to contend with these kind of giants of industry and technology and American culture. And so in a sense, I wanted to sort of explore, and Paul felt like my way into the story, like my lens on the story. He was a normal person in some sense, in so far over his head, quaking in his boots as he had to stand across from, you know, the great Thomas Edison, who was by the 1880s, arguably, if not probably, the most famous man in America. And Paul had just gotten to New York from Nashville. I mean, it was this, he felt like his amazing way into a story about scientists. And it allowed me to sort of write about them in a different way, not showing it from their perspective. There's all these bits in the novel where he talks about Westinghouse will, or Tesla will try to explain some bit of science, and Paul, our lawyer, our narrator, will kind of wave him away and say, no, I don't care. Just give me the nutshell. What's the basic piece of information I need so I can do my job? And then conversely, Paul Cravath will try to explain to George Westinghouse some bit of patent law, and Westinghouse will say, yeah, I don't care about the law stuff. Just what's the nugget that I need to be able to go and do my job? And so I was interested in these people with different skill sets, different areas in which they're very, very smart, kind of finding a way to talk together. And it allowed for a great way to communicate information to the audience because they were each lay people in each other's fields.
And so discussing all those bits and pieces of information, you have the law piece, you have the science piece. How did you go about researching it? Because that's a lot of information.
It was, and it certainly took a while. And that was, I try to be voracious in my research. So kind of anything and everything I can get my hands on, which, when I started meant biographies of all the people in question, autobiographies in Nikola Tesla's case. There is, and interestingly, there isn't very much written about Paul Cravath. There's no official biography of him. There's a couple magazine profiles from when he was alive, but just a couple. We have very little in the way of concrete information. And the same is true about George Westinghouse. There is no official scholarly biography of Westinghouse, which I always suggest that someone should write. But that meant, from my perspective, reading a lot of newspapers from the period, a lot of magazines, scientific journals, diaries of people involved. Thomas Edison's diary is online as of this moment. Rutgers University has posted every page of it at the Edison Papers on their site. It's really cool. If you want to click on it someday, you can go and just sort of click through, pick a random day and see what Edison wrote in his diary that way. It's cool to get a good sense of it.
Really cool.
It's interesting. He has terrible handwriting, and it's really hard to decipher it, but if you spend a minute and figure it out, he talks about his dreams very vividly. You get a really great sense of his personality through it. It makes me glad that I don't keep a diary because the idea of people, 100 years after my death, pouring through it online sounds terrifying.
Yeah, that would not be good.
But yes, he may be embarrassed about it, but it is really cool to see. So going through all of that was really helpful. And then, of course, talking to experts. I had lawyers who I worked with who helped explain the history of patent law, electricians to help with, and electrical scientists to help with the electricity stuff. But it's a lot about kind of getting this big area of understanding from my part so that I can then kind of dive in very specifically and give the reader just as much information as she needs to sort of make the narrative happen and to try and kind of dramatize these bits of history. I think the fear with a piece like this is always that it will feel like a Wikipedia entry and not a novel. And it's a novel. It should be emotional and lively and fun and entertaining and passionate, because these were passionate people. You were asking earlier about writing about scientists, and I think that's something that I really admire about scientists is they're passionate and they're driven and they're obsessive. I mean, they devote their entire lives to these subjects that the general population would consider arcane. And maybe as someone who does that myself, I can sort of identify with it.
So do you have sort of a list of scientists that you'd like to write about? Do you have a list of people that you would like to write about? What's next for whatever you plan on doing?
I don't have a list. There's some things that I'm starting to work on. I'm starting to work on a third book. I'm starting to work on another film. We're making the film version of The Last Days of Night. So that's taking up a lot of time right now as we're in prep. But I think I'm going to try and stay away from true stories for my next little bit. I keep telling the people I work with that I want to, agents and whatnot, that I really want to try writing something that doesn't involve spending 2 years of research before I can write a word. But of course, now I'm starting to work on my third book and have now turned it into this massive research project. And I'm talking to all these scientists, and it is sort of about scientists, but about made up scientists this time, which I'm kind of excited to try my hand at.
Would you ever write about Elon Musk?
I might be too afraid to write about Elon Musk, but he's a really interesting figure. And one thing with this book that I kept looking at or kept thinking about was the way these kind of great, the way the scientific rivalries of the 19th century look like the ones of the 20th and 21st century. the way that Thomas Edison would always kind of talk about George Westinghouse and say, oh, that guy, he's not a scientist, he's just a businessman, which is kind of exactly what Steve Jobs would always say about Bill Gates. And then conversely, Westinghouse would always say about Edison, you know, he's not even an engineer, he's just a salesman. And that is, I think, word for word what Gates would say about Jobs. And I think we're starting to see it now with Musk, and I'm trying to find who Musk's great rival is. Maybe it's Peter Thiel. Maybe it'll be someone else. Yes. Maybe it's someone in the Google self-driving cars. But because I think the issues and the sort of philosophical issues that Edison and Westinghouse were asking are similar to the ones that Musk and his competitors are dealing with too, as they work on self-driving cars or AI or what have you, which is kind of, what does it mean to invent something? What does it mean to kind of have had an idea? How do you take the raw idea of something and actually turn it into a product that you can sell in a store and give to a public? And I'm kind of fascinated by the way the same scientific controversies seem to, you know, erupt century after century.
And so you talked before about not wanting to write another true story initially. Wouldn't you think that that's a little easier than trying to develop your own story? What do you think is the difference there?
It's a great question, and I think I'm now finding it very hard when I have to make the whole thing up from scratch. I'm very used to, you know, what I like about working on true stories is that in the sense, it's always felt to me as if someone else has already done the first draft for me. You know, if I don't know what to have happen next, I can just look up what actually happened next, and put that in there. And in some sense, it feels, working on a true story feels sculptural. You know, it's the thing about there being a big block of clay, and I'm just kind of whittling away at it until the sculpture emerges. It's a lot of cutting, a lot of condensing, a lot of amalgamating to sort of fit a true story into a narrative build a narrative out of a true story rather than sort of coming up with one from scratch. But I also think a lot of the true stories, or a lot of the kind of fiction that I like, even if it's not based on a true story, there's still, it always comes from something very real. It comes from real people, whether it's the writer's life or something that they've been inspired by. And since I seem sort of congenitally averse to autobiography, I am much more excited about finding people who seem really fascinating to me and writing a ton about them.
Cool. What advice do you have for young aspiring writers, or maybe just people who want to get better at writing?
Write a lot would be my first piece of advice, which sounds simple, but it's not. I mean, writing's really hard, and it takes a lot of it.
It's very hard.
Yes. I mean, it takes a lot to get good at it. And I think there are people, I wake up every day and keep waiting for that to be the day when I wake up and can say to myself, oh, I know how to write now. I'm really good at this. But, you know, I'm only 34, but at this point, it still has not happened. There's no day where I'm like, oh, I figured out how to write, I know how to do this job. It's a new challenge every day. And I think kind of embracing that and saying, you can get better at it, but you're never going to get perfect at it, and you're never going to be as good as you want to be at it, which is all the more reason to just keep doing it and keep refining. I meet writers sometimes who are young who are afraid of doing a lot of drafts of things, or think that somehow, if you do a first draft and then throw it out and start again, that's a failure. Maybe it is for some other writers, but for me, I mean, that's common. I did kind of, I think, 8 or 9 major drafts of Last Days of Night,
the book.
I'm on draft 12 of the screenplay right now for Imitation Game. There were probably 30 by the time we were done, I'm just guessing. So it's normal, and the first few of all of those were just, you know, thrown in a garbage can. And I think that is very much a part of my process, and to sort of, I think there was something I found valuable about looking at those early attempts, even the ones that get thrown out, and realizing that they're not failures, they're successes, because you learn something from them.
So you gave such an incredibly powerful speech at the Oscars.
So I would like for this moment to be for that kid out there who feels like she's weird, or she's different, or she doesn't fit in anywhere. Yes, you do. I promise you do. You do. Stay weird, stay different, and then when it's your turn and you are standing on this stage, please pass the same message to the next person who comes along. Thank you so much.
How did you keep your composure?
Thank you for that. It was a little bit difficult. I think, you know, first of all, you walk up there and helpfully the lights are so bright, you can't actually see anyone's faces. You're just sort of staring into this big red 45 counting down the seconds that you have to speak. So I couldn't actually see the crowd. I couldn't see anyone's reaction. So in a strange way, it felt like I was all alone up there, which I think actually helped out. But I'd been given some good tips on, you know, if you're ever on stage, this is what you do, from our editor, Billy, who'd edited Imitation Game and who's a friend, and he had won an Oscar before. And so he kind of gave me some good tips about how you don't, what was the rule? Your clock doesn't start until you walk towards the microphone. So if you need a moment to compose yourself, you take it as you're taking the trophy, pause, and then you can walk towards the microphone and your 45 seconds start. So Oscar stagecraft, if you ever get up there yourself. But Billy had given me that warning and a few others. But it was pretty strange to sort of speak into a brightly lit microphone for 45 seconds.
Well, there you have it, guys. If you ever win an Oscar, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for being with us for this episode of Volta Insider with Graham Moore. I'm Rachel Greenberg, and this is Volta Insider.